Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett. Tonight on PBS News Weekend, One-on-One, my interview with Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, how he's tackling persistent flight delays and cancellations, and how Democrats should highlight historic infrastructure investments.
This is a huge achievement that we need to make sure is well understood, even if that means being maybe a little shameless compared to how we're used to being on my side of the aisle.
Then climate costs. With Democrats' agenda stalled in Congress, we look at the economic effects of unchecked climate change. And metaverse dangers, how future technologies could accelerate the spread of dangerous conspiracy theories, like the ones that fueled the insurrection. All that and the day's headlines on tonight's PBS News Weekend. Good evening. It's good to be with you. And we start tonight with news about the monkeypox outbreak. Today, the World Health Organization announced the virus has now reached more than 70 countries and should be treated as a global emergency. That's the WHO's highest level of alert. Monkeypox has existed in parts of Africa for decades, but since May, cases have been reported on five other continents unaccustomed to the virus. In the U.S., there are nearly 3,000 cases of monkeypox, that's according to the CDC, and nearly 17,000 cases worldwide. Washington, D.C. has the highest number of monkeypox cases per capita in the country. Today, the war in Ukraine hit its 150th day, and the State Department has confirmed that two Americans have been killed in the country's eastern Donbass region. Elsewhere, Russian missiles struck the southern port city of Odessa one day after the two countries agreed to resume vital grain exports. Cell phone video captured a massive explosion around tankers and shipping containers. No injuries were reported, but the U.S. and United Nations condemned the strikes. Millions of tons of grain have been trapped in the country, ready to export around the world. And the White House released a new letter from the president's physician today, saying that President Biden most likely contracted BA5, the highly contagious and now dominant COVID strain in the U.S. The president's symptoms are said to include a sore throat and body aches, as well as a runny nose and a loose cough. But his vital signs remain, quote, entirely normal. Today, President Biden's chief medical advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci, said the president is on the mend.
The president is doing very well. He continues to improve. So we continue to always be careful. But really, the chances of him getting into severe difficulty is very, very low, given the fact that he's vaccinated, doubly boosted, and he's on an antiviral drug.
And a wildfire near Yosemite has exploded to nearly 7,000 acres in just a day, triggering widespread evacuations. The Oak Fire started yesterday afternoon and has already grown into the state's largest active wildfire. It is 0% contained, has destroyed at least 10 structures, and is threatening thousands more, according to Cal Fire. That's as temperatures soar across the country this weekend. According to the National Weather Service, more than 85 million Americans were under heat warnings or advisories today. And still to come on PBS News Weekend, the economic costs of unchecked climate change and the new technologies accelerating conspiracy theories.
This is PBS News Weekend from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour, weeknights on PBS.
From a supply chain crisis to a summer of flight delays and cancellations, all of it has fallen to Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg to help solve. The 40-year-old former presidential candidate and mayor of South Bend, Indiana, also has the task of overseeing one of the most significant investments in America's infrastructure, roads, bridges, and rail, in more than half a century. I sat down with Secretary Buttigieg for a wide-ranging interview at his agency's headquarters and asked what Americans should expect to see as communities across the country cash in on the president's trillion-dollar infrastructure package.
Well, you're going to see it in ways big and small, and the airports is a good example. So traditionally, we've funded what you might call the back of the house on airports, the air traffic control tower, the apron, the runway. We still do. But now we've had a program that we can use to fund the terminal, the part that you interact with as an individual passenger. And we're doing it in communities of all sizes. I was in LA celebrating what we're doing there with a $50 million grant to simplify traffic through what they call the horseshoe, which you can get tied up in mm-hmm. for half an hour, even after you've dropped somebody off.
Yeah.
It ranges from something like that at one of the busiest airports in the world, all the way to a place like Chamberlain, South Dakota, where their general aviation terminal is currently a mobile home. And with less than $1 million, we can fund them to have a fixed building. Everything in between is the range of what we can do, whether we're talking about airports, whether we're talking about ports, improving bridges, roads, pretty much anything that affects how people and goods move around this country. We're improving it right now with the funds through this infrastructure deal.
And yet, as you revitalize airports, there are lots of Americans who have significant frustrations with air travel. The DOT just this past week put out a report and showed that complaints against airlines are on the decline since April, but they're still 200% above pre-pandemic levels. How are you trying to address that?
That's right. Our Consumer Protection Office has been overwhelmed with complaints that they are working their way through right now. And I think the flying public is expecting a good level of service from an airline sector that we all rallied to make sure was saved during the worst days of the
pandemic. $50 billion worth of taxpayer money.
That's right. A lot of taxpayer support. And it's a good thing that we did. Otherwise, we might literally not have airlines today. But now the airlines, of course, need to step up and service the tickets that they sell. We have seen improvements. We saw after Memorial Day weekend some really unacceptable numbers in terms of cancellations and delays. I've had a lot of conversations with the airlines since then, and we're seeing the cancellation delay rates moving in the right direction, but still a real struggle to keep up when it comes to staffing. Look, it is a good piece of news. It's great news that passengers have the income and the inclination to take trips that they wouldn't or couldn't a year ago, 2 years ago. We're glad to see the demand back, but now we need to make sure the system can meet that demand.
What about those lawmakers like Bernie Sanders, Democrats in addition to him, who make the case that that $50 billion, that came with strings attached, and that the airlines, when they do cancel on folks, when they do have folks waiting on the tarmac for X amount of hours, they should be fined heavily.
Well, that's part of what we do as a department. Look, our preferred outcome is that the passenger doesn't have this problem in the first place. But when we find that an airline is, for example, failing to issue prompt refunds or in some other way not treating passengers fairly, we will act. As a matter of fact, a few months ago, we issued the stiffest fine in the history of our consumer protection program. And we have ongoing investigations about other practices. Again, we want things to go well, but when they don't, we will act.
One of the most intractable issues, I think, is the pilot shortage, in part because it takes a while to train folks, and doesn't seem to be the number of job candidates coming from the military that you might need. And of course, there are so many pilots who took that early retirement at the height of the pandemic. What's the approach to addressing that?
Well, we really need to build generations of aviation professionals, including pilots. Now, part of it, like any issue where you see perceived labor shortage, has to do with pay. And so I've been encouraged to see a lot of the airlines, especially the regional airlines, that's more the entry level for a career in commercial aviation, they're upping their pay. I think that's going to make a big difference. We also got to stimulate and support that spark of wanting to be involved in aviation from a very early age. So we're supporting a college and even high school curricula that help encourage that. Recently, I was in Compton, a neighborhood in Los Angeles that is a low-income area, where volunteers came together and created a flight school where teenagers, some of them barely old enough to drive, are now getting their first solo flights. They have a fantastic, good-paying career ahead of them, and we need to do more like that, too, to give people who maybe haven't had exposure to that in the past the chance to be part of this. Because as a country, whether it's aviation or whether it's construction, we're trying to do so much that we cannot afford to leave any talent on the table.
You are highly regarded among Democrats as being, I think, one of the greatest assets in terms of messaging that the party has. What should Democrats do heading into this midterm election to better explain what they see as their accomplishments?
What I'll say is this administration has a lot to be proud of. And honestly, I think in normal times, any one of the achievements of this administration, the American Rescue Plan, not to mention the infrastructure law that we're working on, could define an era. Now, of course, we're not in ordinary times. We've seen a lot of extremism in our country. We've seen huge challenges hitting us, whether it's COVID or inflation and the affordability challenge, that make it that much more challenging to have this conversation with the American people. But if you look at what we've done, especially on infrastructure, where year after year, Congress after Congress and multiple presidents talked about a so-called infrastructure week without results, and now it's actually getting done. This is a huge achievement that we need to make sure is well understood, even if that means being maybe a little shameless compared to how we're used to being on my side of the aisle.
Yeah, is that the answer, to be a little shameless?
Well, I think we shouldn't hesitate to make sure people understand why and how these improvements came to their neighborhood. I was back in my hometown of South Bend, and found myself on a trail that had been built that I'd always wanted to do back when I was mayor but didn't have the funding, thanks to funding for the American Rescue Plan. And whether it's small community improvements like that or the millions of people who were lifted out of poverty, again, that rescue plan alone was a huge deal. We shouldn't be afraid to talk about it and talk about why it happened, who was for it and who was against it.
How do you see this current moment? I mean, you are a historic figure, the first openly gay Senate-confirmed member of a presidential cabinet, and yet we're living in a moment where Republicans are actively trying to roll back hard-won protections and rights of the LGBTQ community. How do you see all that?
Well, I think we're in a very precarious moment. A lot of progress has been made in my lifetime. A lot of progress was made in the last 50 years, and now we're seeing it, in many ways, withdrawn. When the Supreme Court ruled against a woman's right to choose, that, I think, prompted many of us to ask, did we just live to see the high watermark of rights and freedoms in our country? You know, historically, rights and freedoms have always expanded. From one era to the next, it's always been more free and more just, even if imperfectly so, than it was before. And the question now is, are we going to start going backwards? Right now, it is extremely disturbing to, as a married gay man and a member of the LGBTQ community, not only to see our rights coming up for debate once again, but to see settled law called into question, and to see most members of one of the two political parties, when it came to a policy vote in the U.S. Congress, vote against my marriage. I mean, that day I was testifying in the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, having, for the most part, what I considered to be very civilized and high-minded exchanges with members from both sides of the aisle on transportation policy and what we were doing about everything from trucking safety to pipeline improvements. And the thought that a few hours later, some of those same people that I was sitting in that room with walked down the hall into the House chamber and voted against my marriage is a troubling thing to take on board.
Secretary Pete Buttigieg, appreciate your time.
Good to be with you.
Around the world, the ravages of climate change are evident in record high temperatures, floods, fires, and other natural disasters. Here in the U.S., President Joe Biden is taking executive action to address the climate crisis, citing climate change as both a national security risk and an economic risk. My colleague Ali Rogan takes a closer look now at the other economic costs of inaction.
A major plan from Democrats in Congress to address climate change is now all but dead. Last week, West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin said he would not support the legislation, citing what he said was the proposal's inflationary impact. But the White House Office of Management and Budget says failing to act on climate change could cost the federal government $2 trillion annually. And a recent study from Dartmouth University found the United States alone was responsible for over $1.8 trillion in losses to developing countries between 1990 and 2014. Joining me now to discuss the economic impacts of climate change in action are Mary Ann Hitt, she's the West Virginia-based senior director of the advocacy group Climate Imperative, and Darna Noor, climate reporter for the Boston Globe. Thank you both so much for joining us. Mary Ann, I'd like to start with you. Senator Manchin, as we said, has cited the inflationary impacts of these proposals, which included tax credits to encourage clean energy, incentives to purchase electric vehicles. How would you respond to his concerns about inflation?
The sad reality is that this bill actually would have helped address inflation because it would have helped bring energy prices down for regular Americans, and that's by making clean energy, which is already cheaper than fossil fuels, more available to more people. And he let that slip through his fingers. And it's a real missed opportunity for folks here in West Virginia and around the country to lower our energy bills and tackle the climate crisis at the same time.
And Darna Marianne just mentioned some of the impacts that actually affect both West Virginia and nationally, but I want to drill down into what you're seeing on a national scale. What are some of the arguments on an economic basis that climate action advocates are making right now?
I think that what we're seeing is a refusal to sort of take on the bold action that we need to take on the climate crisis. One of the effects that we're seeing this is continuing to sink costs into fossil fuel infrastructure and other infrastructure that's really not going to be able to be around in the future if we want to essentially have a livable future on Earth. And so continuing to spend money on these technologies that we need to be phasing out is not a very good idea.
And Darna, as we said, the Office of Management and Budget is estimating that the federal government could lose up to $2 trillion a year due to climate change inaction. What are some of the factors that lead to a conclusion like that?
Well, again, by continuing to sink costs into technology and into infrastructure that we know we should not have around anymore. So that's things like fossil fuel plants, you know, but also things like expanded highways, which create a sort of market for more cars and things like this. There's the cost that climate disaster itself can kind of levy on our economies and on people. You know, every time, for instance, that infrastructure is destroyed, a highway is destroyed, a building is destroyed by the climate crisis, by, you know, a hurricane or a flood or a heat wave or whatever it is, if we continue to ignore the impacts of the climate crisis and rebuild as though you know, another hurricane, flood or heat wave is not going to come, I think we're going to see that we're wasting a lot of money.
Lastly, to both of you, the Dartmouth report that we talked about in the introduction, which quantified that U.S. carbon emissions have done $1 trillion worth of damage to other countries from 1990 to 2014. That includes the damage to other major carbon emitters like Brazil and India, but also to developing nations like Venezuela and Nigeria. First to you, Marianne, why is a study like this important?
A few years ago at one of the big global climate conferences, the developed nations of the world pledged $100 billion to help the developing world with climate solutions. And we have not delivered on those funds. And in the period that since then, those developing countries have been hit the hardest by climate impacts. And that eventually spills back over onto our borders when there are food shortages, water shortages, triggering refugee crises and global instability around the world. So the developed world needs to step up and do our part to help these countries face the climate crisis, because, again, ultimately it will spill back over onto our border.
And Darna, lastly to you, this study also found that the U.S.'s own carbon emissions actually boosted its economy by $183 billion over the same period. Does that make it harder to argue that the economic costs for climate change action, when over the years polluting industries have actually been so much a part of the what drove economic development in this country?
I think it demonstrably has made it harder to sort of overcome this challenge. But I would say that part of the reason that these polluting industries have been such a huge part of the economy is because the U.S. pours billions and billions of subsidies into them. If the U.S. instead decided to subsidize or even, you know, create a public sector for clean industries, I think that we'd see that those would end up being a huge part of our economy, and we could really help other nations to sort of make that transition as well. So I think that, yes, while there's so much that we do have to spend, there's also quite a lot to be gained for, you know, the U.S. as a whole, for the world, and also for us on the individual level.
Marianne Hitt with Climate Imperative, Darna Noor with the Boston Globe, thank you both so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.
If tech industry watchers are right, we will soon be living in the metaverse. Glimpses of the virtual environment are already among us, from virtual concerts and fashion to popular immersive games like Fortnite and Minecraft. While the virtual world could revolutionize work and play, it could also supercharge conspiracy theories and disinformation campaigns. I spoke about this next generation of the internet, also known as Web3, and the risks that come with it, with Laurie Siegel, CEO of .. Media and a former correspondent for 60 Minutes and CNN. I think it would be helpful if we start with an explanation of what Web3 is, and then explain why it could potentially make online conspiracy even more dangerous and nefarious than it already is.
If you think about Web 1, this was the internet boom and bust of the early 90s, where we were browsing the interwebs for the first time. Then you had Web 2, and this was the rise of mobile and social and thinking about using your phone for Airbnb and Uber. And it was the birth of all of these new economies, essentially. And now we're entering a world called Web 3, which is, if you imagine technology moving beyond your phone, us living in these more interactive and immersive worlds, having communities, having friendships, having digital identities, making money, having jobs you didn't even know could exist in these digital worlds.
After January 6th, as I understand it, you interviewed some of the people who stormed the Capitol, including the guy known as the QAnon shaman, while he was in jail. And you also interviewed his mother. So what did interviews with people like that tell you about how technology can make it really hard for people to change their beliefs once they believe in conspiracy theories, even faced with significant consequences like doing prison time, which he's doing right now?
I mean, I got to tell you, it was pretty astounding. He was pushing back so much on all of these questions on why did you do this? And he was holding on so tightly to these beliefs that had put him behind bars, these conspiracies. And then going out and visiting his mother and interviewing his mother, Martha, where he grew up. And there was just this exchange that we had where she kept talking about he was a part of that day, but he wasn't a part of the bad part of it, the violent part. And I kept saying to her, but all of it was bad. You know, an attack on democracy is horrible. And there was just this moment where she said, but it was all a fraud. The election was a fraud. And having spent a lot of time with groups, extremist groups, I will never forget being out in rural Michigan and speaking to a young man who had just become a Boogaloo Boy, which was an extremist group. And he said, you know, I was lonely during the pandemic. I couldn't go to the gym. And I went on Facebook and he said, and I found this group. And the next thing you know, I was clicking on it and I was surrounded by all these people. I mean, it's a no-brainer that this happened. This was both preventable and this was both predictable. But there's a whole new immersive era of the internet that's happening where these conflicts are going to be even scarier if we don't get on top of them.
So that then explains why Web 3, as you put it, is even more dangerous because it is more immersive, and that people who are looking for connection, when they find it in a sort of environment, a Web 3 environment, it becomes harder to find your way out.
That's exactly right. Our children are going to be growing up in these environments that are immersive. There are going to be new platforms for domestic terrorism recruitment, for children to be recruited into these types of groups. And so how are we going to figure out how to regulate these new technologies that people are investing billions of dollars into when it comes to Web3, because it's all the rage right now? And I'll give you one specific example. It's called a DAO, a decentralized autonomous network. And it sounds super wonky, but if I could just explain it to you, it's like a group chat with a balance sheet and it's run on crypto. And people have the ability to raise extraordinary amounts of money in just a couple days. And at its best, DAOs in the future of Web3 could give people the ability to organize and fund projects in a setting that could really benefit community building and force organizations and businesses to rethink their business models. Now, in the worst of settings, imagine if QAnon could organize, if 4chan could organize so quickly using cryptocurrency, using a lot of this anonymity. So now imagine January 6th with a DAO. And so I'm not trying to give ideas here as much as I'm trying to say we have to think about new technology as it is being built, because we haven't even figured out how to regulate, quote, Web 2, these big tech monopolies. And now we're entering a whole new generation of the internet. And we've got to talk about our children growing up in these immersive worlds. And how do we actually build them with a humanity first approach?
Are these active conversations happening inside companies like Facebook?
Yeah, Facebook has put quite a bit of money towards safety in the metaverse. And I think there's a lot of skepticism around that. And then you talk about Web3, the idea behind Web3 is it is more decentralized, is there should be lots of companies that have a lot of this different type of power. But there's really no structure, right? And we don't really have an ethical construct for this. I just spoke to one investor and I said, what do you think is the most important thing we need to think about when it comes to the unintended consequence of the next generation of the internet? And he looked at me and he said, Lori, we should believe in the future, every single thing we see on the internet is going to be fake. And this is coming from a very prominent investor investing in the future of tech companies. So I think it's important to have these conversations now and try to get some of these good people in the doors now, because we certainly have a playbook of what went wrong over the last generation of tech.
Lori Siegel, thanks so much for your time and for your insights.
Thanks for having me.
And that is our show for tonight. I'm Jeff Bennett. Thanks for spending part of your Saturday with us, and we'll see you back here tomorrow evening.